is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, as global temperatures rise, the sea rises too. We find out why and hear from island nations who may be flooded out. Proponents of nuclear power say people in other nations are not as fearful of the atom as we are. We talk green about it. And on the Earth calendar, we sniff the wildflowers that bloom in the spring as they paint a path of color up the entire Appalachian mountain chain. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. Temperatures have risen over the past century, and the warmest years have come in the last two decades. Along with the climate, many believe the oceans are also warming, leading to a rise in sea level which may threaten coastal areas around the world. Some countries, like Bangladesh, and island nations like Micronesia, may lose a majority of their territory. And in this country, some of our most populated areas may become uninhabitable. The Environment Show's Thomas Lally reports.
The world's oceans are today creeping up at a rate of about 2 millimeters a year. That may not seem like much, but as the climate gets warmer, the process is expected to accelerate, and by the end of the next century, the oceans may be 2 to 3 feet above their present level. And for areas only a few feet above sea level now, the effects could be devastating.
Sea level is directly linked to global warming. That is to say, the reason the mid-latitude glaciers are melting is because the Earth's getting warmer, and of course, the reason the water is expanding is because it's being heated up. It's called thermal expansion. So indeed, sea level rise, this worldwide rise, is directly linked to global warming.
Stephen Leatherman is a professor and director of the Laboratory for Coastal Research at the University of Maryland. He says the seas have risen 6 inches in the 20th century, and today at least 70% of the world's beaches are eroding.
Well, the areas that they're going to have the most problem, of course, are going to be the deltas, river delta areas of the world, like Bangladesh, a country which is totally a winded river delta. And those areas, they're right at sea level. There's millions of people who live right at sea level, and, of course, any small rise in sea level pushes the land inland. And so those are the first areas that they're already having problems. I mean, we're already seeing the problems. People who live on barrier beaches along the Atlantic and Gulf Coast, these beaches have quite a bit of erosion problems. It's in the news quite a bit about trying to stop the erosion and the storm damage and everything else. So the story of the coast is the problems are already here. We don't have to wait for them. We're already having those problems.
Although many parts of this country are expected to be affected by rising seas, like much of the Gulf and Atlantic coasts, the nations most actively working on this issue are those which may be inundated 100 years from now. The Marshall Islands are in the South Pacific, isolated by hundreds of miles from the nearest continent. People there have traditionally lived very closely with the sea. Espen Ronenberg, minister counselor at the Marshall Islands Mission to the United Nations, says the elders in his country say they have noticed a change in the ocean.
Well, the Marshall Islands are very, very low-lying. The average height is about 6 meters, but 2 meters is generally most. For example, the capital island, 2 meters is the average there. So a sea level rise of say 50 centimeters would mean a loss of perhaps 80% of land area in the Marshall Islands, and that's a land loss that would completely destroy the infrastructure of the country.
Ronenberg and a vast majority of the world's scientists and governments say the climate is changing because humans are releasing so-called greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Most of these gases are created when we drive cars or burn fuel for electricity. The nations of the world have been meeting to address global warming, culminating at the end of this year in Kyoto, Japan, where a final agreement is expected. Ronenberg says a meeting earlier this year in Bonn, Germany, did not encourage him, but he says island nations like the Marshall Islands will keep up the pressure.
Well, Well, the recent negotiations in Bonn were not entirely successful, but as far as Kyoto is concerned, I waver between optimism and pessimism. It depends on what reports I've been reading and with whom I've been discussing the matter that particular day. There's a great deal to be optimistic about. At the same time, we know that there are so many powerful interests at play, and I really don't know how we as small islands representatives can present a counter to that powerful influence.
Ronenberg says combating climate change and its effects, like rising sea levels, will be difficult. Many greenhouse gases last hundreds and even thousands of years in the atmosphere, so many believe we're locked into a warming climate for the foreseeable future. Ronenberg says cutting back our emissions of greenhouse gases will require a shift away from an economy like the one we have today, based on fossil fuels, to one based on so-called sustainable technology, a term no one can quite define just yet. He condemns the positions of many industries which are fighting cuts in greenhouse gases.
To try introduce this idea that there is still a debate, I find rather repugnant. We really don't need the added difficulty of businesses trying to undermine the scientific discourse. This is the sort of nonsense that has been going on with the debate over smoking and cancer, and we don't need to have that introduced into the environmental debate.
Espen Runenberg is the Minister Counsel at the Marshall Islands Mission to the United Nations. He says he has received support recently by some in the insurance industry, which he says is recognizing its vulnerability to the effects of climate change. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
We're talking green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today we're talking about nuclear power, and we want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Our guests are Henry Kendall, Nobel Prize-winning physicist at MIT and chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists. He joins us from Massachusetts. And Richard Rhodes, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian of the atomic age and journalist who has been researching nuclear issues for more than 15 years. He's with us from Connecticut. Richard Rhodes, I'd like to start with you. You've recently appeared in a television documentary about nuclear energy, and the thrust of your argument is that the fear Americans have of nuclear power is irrational. As we broadcast, nuclear plants are closing in the United States because they're so expensive to operate that they seem not to be able to produce electricity at a competitive price. If that's the case, does it make any difference whether popular concern about nuclear power is rational or not?
Well, you know, I don't think our documentary really is about how irrational Americans are about nuclear power. It, in fact, was an attempt to look at the contrast, the really very interesting contrast, between attitudes in France and Japan and attitudes in this country. There's no question that the bottom line for nuclear power, like any other source of energy, has to be finally economics. And as I understand it, economics aren't going to work in the United States these days. So in that sense, the issue is moot. But it's interesting to ask the question, and this is the question we asked, why are there such differences in different places in attitudes towards this particular source of energy? And that's what we explored.
Let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. And let's go to Eileen from Washington, D.C. Eileen, you're talking green in the Environment Show.
Hi, how are you today?
Okay.
I would just like to set the record straight here. Nuclear power supplies 20% of our electricity in the United States, and plants have been operating safely for 30 years. I would disagree with a statement by the host that nuclear power is not competitive. Nuclear power production costs are competitive with other sources of electricity. There may be individual plants that are not competitive in their local area. But by and large, I think that when we see, as we move to a restructured electricity market, nuclear plants will be able to compete and they will continue to operate. I'd also like to point out that nuclear energy is responsible for the reduction of carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere of 1.5 billion metric tons since 1974.
Okay. Well,
my question to Dr. Kendall is, if not nuclear and if not clean coal, what do we rely on for electricity production in the United States that would still be economic and efficient?
Well, first of all, the economics of nuclear power are much more sour than you've indicated, because when the nuclear proponents set out the allegedly low cost of nuclear power, they do a little bit of creative bookkeeping there. They leave out all the costs of the front-end part of nuclear power, as well as waste disposal, and now they've started leaving out in these estimates the actual costs of the plants. And the costs that are quoted are simply the current operating costs, which look superficially competitive, but the full costs are far from that, and nuclear power gets heavy subsidies from the government, and estimates are if those subsidies were lifted, nuclear power would double in cost.
Nuclear.
Well, Eileen, thanks for your call, and one of the things that I've thought has been interesting on this is that if you look at the cost of decommissioning, that appears to be almost as expensive and sometimes even more so than building the plant itself. And one wonders whether that has been appropriately accounted for, since I know there's a plant in Connecticut we covered on the Environment Show, and they had a reserve which is less than half of the money that they were going to need to shut it down. So
it's not included in the current quotations of the cost of nuclear electricity.
All right,
electricity.
Let's go back to the phones. Conrad from Southampton, Massachusetts, you're talking Green on the Environment Show.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment about what's going on with the law that was passed in the Senate that's going to be put in front of the House about shipping nuclear waste across the country to Nevada. It looks like that's where the proponents want to send it.
Yes, just went through. What's your question?
So my question is, it looks to me like nuclear power, at this point, the pools are filling up to store the waste, and the companies that run the nuclear power plants are a little frantic about what to do because they can't afford to put it anywhere, and probably Yucca Mountain has 8 earthquake faults, so that's not going to be any good anyway. It seems to me this is the time when nuclear power either has to be stopped or what else could happen with it.
Okay, good question. Richard Rhodes, you've given this some thought. The question, I guess, is waste disposal and where we go with that.
Well, I guess the question is, if the caller would like to stop this 20% of U.S. electricity generation, what he imagines we would substitute for it, even in the short run. Obviously, there are lots of choices in the long run, but I don't quite see how we shut down 20% of our electrical supply because the waste hasn't been stuck in the ground yet. It isn't clear to me that sticking it in the ground is the best place to deal with it anyway. But if that's what Congress just voted, what I think they just voted was to continue the Yucca Mountain operation, there are significant issues there for Nevada, which itself has no nuclear power and feels most uncomfortable with the notion that it's going to be the repository for everyone else in the country. Again, we looked at the French issue and asked, what have they done? Since they obviously have the same problems we do, why have they succeeded evidently in resolving some of these issues, at least of trust with their people? And it was interesting to find that they have defined their waste repositories as underground research laboratories.
Isn't that just greenwashing with a fancy nuclear name?
Well, I don't know if it is or not. It may well. I think it applies to something that Robert Oppenheimer argued years and years ago about the whole issue of nuclear energy, including the question of weapons proliferation, which was you couldn't just have inspectors going around looking for bombs or whatever. It needed to be an active, ongoing part of science. So I think that's really what the French probably have in mind.
Right. Dr. Kendall, your observations on the waste issue?
Well, the waste issue has been a 40-year series of blunders. way, way back.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Yes, and we agree also that you cannot shut down the nuclear power program instantly in this country. It's what the electrical engineers call a switching transient. You cause all kind of trouble. It has to be, if it is going to go, it should be phased out gracefully so it doesn't cause other upsets. But the long series of competent studies suggested that over the extraordinarily long term that the waste remains radioactive, it should be put out of harm's way, deep in the earth. Now, 20 or 30 years of blundering around, false starts in Lyons, Kansas, and other places. The site in Nevada is designated as highly seismic, not exactly the best choice, and an aquifer, a small one, runs underneath the site. Has gotten into enormous political difficulty. Now, what should be done with it is probably not to go for above-ground monitored storage for thousands or tens of thousands of years. Who in 4 or 5 or 10 or 60,000 years is going to be watching the radioactive waste, which once upon a time contributed to lighting up Las Vegas and having fountains in Tucson and Phoenix? Stuff's got to be put out of the way. It's irresponsible otherwise. But they
Dr. Kennelly,
can't seem to do it.
Are you suggesting that those fountains in Phoenix are not going to be there 60,000 years from now?
Well, I think
what a terrible thought.
One has to consider that possibility. And so the question is, we have to take some responsibility for the waste, put it in some place where it will not return to injure humans in subsequent generations. And we have not had a program, and neither do the French, or the Germans, or anyone else yet, which has successfully demonstrated that this stuff can be put away, although I think it's technically feasible. We've had very serious bureaucratic blundering all over the place in that area, and that's generally agreed to.
But I think
we're running out of time. I do want to reach Scott in D.C. Scott, you're talking Green on the Environment Show. Quickly,
thank you very much,
question.
Peter. I'm somewhat disappointed. I had hoped that this program would have addressed some current issues, such as the climate change issue, such as what are some of the alternatives to nuclear power and coal generation, which have significant problems. And the issue is there that instead of using discredited folks like Robert DuPont and so forth to continue to push this bogus fear theory, why not take a look at the fact that in places like France, where the filmmakers point to as a success story, in fact, France's nuclear program is $30 billion in debt, and the only reason why they moved forward with it was in large part because of the central control of the French government. We have a much more democratic and open system here. That, in itself, will support much more of a hybrid of alternatives, such as natural gas and solar.
Let's see if we get some comments on that again, because our time is short, and thanks for your question. Richard Rhodes, do you want to start on that?
I can certainly report what the French say their situation is, and that is, given their lack of other fossil fuel resources, they felt that the only way they could continue as a viable national state was to develop nuclear power. That's what they've done. Whether there are debts or not, I can't speak to that.
The United States is not France, and the United States has enormous technical resources and the capacity to move towards solar, wind, and that wonderful source of electricity, essentially, which is conservation and more efficient use of electricity and all energy sources. Greenhouse warming and the climatic disruption, which will almost certainly follow from it, is an enormous concern, and the United States should have put its shoulder to the wheel and developed the technologies to replace unsatisfactory energy sources.
Okay. Again, quickly, Michael from Los Angeles, you're talking Green in the Environment Show.
Yes, I have a question. If we are to believe that the radiation risks are as dangerous as the Union of Concerned Scientists want us to believe, how do you justify spending all the time and effort into minimizing exposures from nuclear power, which is a very small exposure, when the overwhelming majority of man-made exposures are medical? The obvious answer being that there's a benefit, but nearly two-thirds of most x-rays are usually done to either generate revenue or to prevent malpractice suits.
All right, well, Aside from the X-ray issue, Dr. Kendall, do you want to comment briefly?
Well, first of all, I did not at all quote the Union of Concerned Scientists' position. I quoted the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on risks, and they were my source of presumably authoritative information on the 50-50 chance of having a catastrophic accident over the next decade or two or three. So we have to be careful of the sources there. And I think that estimate is right. Nuclear power has been turned back by every country in the world that has had the option to do it. And the United States has that option, and it should be developing other energy sources and much more promptly and vigorously.
Let me
okay,
just respond
a call from Gil.
Let me just respond to that.
Sure.
The fact is nuclear power is being developed these days in South Korea, in South Asia in general. I don't understand what Henry means by people who had the choice. Their choice has been to go nuclear because they're concerned about pollution primarily from the coal they burn.
Well, there's certainly serious problems in Japan socially with nuclear power. The same sorts of mismanagements that we have seen here, accidents, near misses, radioactive exposures that were undesired and unwanted and unexpected. So there's more of a problem out there than I think you realize.
I'm afraid our time is up. I don't think we have agreement, but I think we certainly have enlightenment. We've been talking green about nuclear power, and my guests have been Henry Kendall, Nobel Prize-winning physicist at MIT and chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists, and Richard Rhodes, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian of the atomic age and journalist. We'd like to hear what you think. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Stay tuned. The Earth Calendar is next. Up and down the Appalachian Mountains of the eastern United States, a ribbon of flowers is spreading from south to north. The Appalachians boast 2,700 varieties of wildflowers, and many bloom in the spring to take advantage of sunlight, which gets blocked later in the year when trees produce leaves.
At this time of year, the forest trees will be flowering at the same time, but they're all wind-pollinated, and it's a distinct advantage for them to shed their pollen when they don't have leaves on them. And so the wildflowers take advantage of this by being on the forest floor and having pollinators available to them. And also, of course, they undergo most of their photosynthesis at this time of year. So they're pumping out energy through photosynthesis, and this energy is being used to form flowers and then seeds and fruits.
Duncan Porter is a professor of botany and curator of the herbarium at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg. He says this is the time of year many wildflowers are active, so that when the sunlight is blocked by trees, they've already spread their seeds, produced fruit, and sexually reproduced. The leaves die by summer, and whatever energy is left is stored in the roots to prepare for winter. Professor Porter says this process takes place over a huge swath of land.
If you were to be out in space and look at it, you'd see the wave of flowering starting out in Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi, going up through the Appalachians, up into Pennsylvania and New York, up into New England, and finally picking up in southeastern Canada.
Many believe there's no better place on Earth in spring than the southern U.S. In cold climates, winter's grasp only subsides just before summer, and in warmer areas, springtime is hardly noticed. But in the South, spring comes slow and sweet, quietly spreading flowers and greenery over the landscape. Professor Porter says wildflowers know when to bloom because of a chemical called florigen. In the off-season, florigen inhibits growth, but when light and temperature are just right, the florigen is received as a message to grow.
They all have receptors, generally chemical receptors, within their tissues that respond probably first to increasing temperatures. And it's not just that the temperature gets up to a certain level. It's that it gets up to a certain level a certain number of days. And that seems to trigger growth from beneath the ground, and then as the leaves and the stem come up above the surface, daylight plays a great role. Change in daylight, and actually it's not so much daylight as night length. As night length decreases, then many of these plants begin to flower.
Professor Duncan Porter of Virginia Tech. He says all terrestrial plants and animals have chemicals like fluorogen in them, which respond to light and temperature. And this includes humans. So if you're feeling a bit antsy, at this time of year, there's a good reason. But imagine how you'd feel if, like a wildflower, you'd have to cram a whole year into a few short months. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, a lot about cats, large ones. We hear about efforts to save the biggest cats in the world, the Siberian tigers, who weigh as much as 800 pounds. There are only 200 to 400 left in the wild. Mountain lions and Californians are fighting it out for territory in the Golden Gate State. We talk green about it. And author Gregory McNamee tells us the legend of a hunter who killed great beasts in mythical times. Singer-songwriter Barb Barton says she can hear crocuses popping over the bird songs of spring, so she sings about it. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. At the beginning of the century, 8 subspecies of tiger were found on the Earth. Today, there are only 5. As 3 have become extinct. The most magnificent is the Panthera tigris altica, otherwise known as the Siberian tiger. The biggest of the world cats, the male Siberian tiger grows to 800 pounds in weight and 10 feet in length. With the opening of Russia to world trade and increasing logging in the Russian Far East, the fate of the Siberian tiger hangs in the balance. It's estimated that approximately 200 to 400 of the black and orange striped beasts still survive. Howard Quigley is president of the Hornica Wildlife Institute and co-director of the Siberian Tiger Project. The project seeks to develop long-range plans to ensure the survival of the huge cats. Quigley says simply being on land inhabited by the tiger is an unforgettable experience.
I think one thing about working with such an exotic animal in its own homeland is simply being able to see its own marks on the land. One of the most impressive situations that I've been in, and I've had many experiences around the world with different wildlife species, one of the most impressive situations I've ever been in is to walk through the Russian forest, or the Russian taiga, as they call it, in the snow, in a fresh snow, and then to come upon the tracks of Siberian tiger there in the snow, there in front of you, because it really is almost a mystical experience. Here's this huge track carved out in the snow, the pads of this mighty beast in the snow, you might say, and it's it truly makes humans humble in that sort of situation. It's truly a very powerful animal, but also a very sort of omnip- omnipotent presence in that sort of in that forest. It represents the Russian taiga more than any other animal.
Tiger habitat is not unlike parts of the United States.
Really, the Russian Far East is a combination of boreal and temperate environments, and it's a lot like the New England of the United States, the New England area, and a lot of broadleaf trees and higher elevation, the spruce fir forest. But it's one of the educational, you might say, difficulties we've had in telling the world about this place is that many people don't know anything about it. And once they see the pictures of where tigers live, they are quite aghast or even amazed by just how similar it is to parts of the United States or even northern Europe.
To save the tiger, Quigley maintains poaching must be stopped and habitat protected. A long-term habitat protection plan includes preservation of blocks of forest and corridors so tigers and other wildlife can move between them.
What we've tried to put in place right now is a long-term habitat protection plan, and what it does is integrates the prospects for development, whether it's mineral development or road development or forest products development, with the biological needs of not only the tiger, but a lot of the other species that live there. And what we've taken now to almost the highest levels of government in Russia is a plan that we think puts in place a template on the land that'll allow for the long-term development, economic development, and the integration. For instance, this plan would allow for a corridor north to south in Tiger Range that would allow for the movement of animals, not only tigers but other animals, between protected areas and through those areas that would be more intensively logged or mined. And thus it allows for conservation in the long run, and also not just conservation but economic development of those resources.
Howard Quigley is the president of the Hornecker Wildlife Institute. The Russian Far East is vast, and the rush to extract its natural resources is intensifying. The Siberian Tiger Project is producing a plan to save the tiger. But the real problem now is to mobilize the political will to implement it in a Russian economic climate where environmental considerations have had little influence on no-holds-barred wheeling and dealing between Russians and foreign traders. We're Talking Green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today, we're talking about mountain lions, also known as cougars. And the question is whether big predators can survive in areas of expanding human population. It's mountain lions, and we want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. My guests today are Lynn Sadler. She's the executive director of the Mountain Lion Foundation. It's a wildlife protection organization based in California, working to stop the inappropriate killing of mountain lions. Also, Steve Torres. He's the coordinator for statewide research and management programs for bighorn sheep and mountain lions for the California Department of Fish and Game. And Rick Hopkins. He's senior wildlife ecologist at Harvey & Associates, which is a consulting firm, and he's been researching mountain lions for over 12 years in the California Bay Area. Rick Hopkins, let's start with you. I think a lot of our listeners have probably not had the opportunity to see a mountain lion. What do they look like?
Well, they tend to be a fairly solid color, sort of tan to red to almost a grayish color cat. All cats, there's some 37 species of cats, are pretty obvious looking. I mean, that's sort of the unique thing about cats is that they all share this, sort of the same
sure.
general features.
How big are these beasts?
In California, they're going to range in the neighborhood. Males will be upwards of 120 to 140 pounds and little higher in some of the snow country in California. And the females will be the 80-90 pound range.
So
they have fairly long tails that'll be nearly as long as their body. they're not as tall as a dog, should we say, you know, that would be of similar weight. They have much greater musculature.
So they are noble, big, wild beasts.
That's a good
in the best sense of the term. Lynn, before a referendum was passed in California protecting the mountain lions, most of them, or a lot of them, were killed off. They were subject to bounty hunting and everything else. Now, I suppose, the threat is habitat, which is being gobbled up by development. Can the mountain lion survive in California?
We certainly hope so. That's our goal. We are losing 150 acres per day in California. And not only are we losing habitat in general, but it's becoming fragmented. And the mountain lion needs, in some cases, up to 150 square miles in which to roam. That kind of solid acreage is becoming more and more difficult to find. And, of course, it takes more than one mountain lion to keep a population going. So things like freeways and subdivisions are interrupting the habitat and making it difficult for the lion to get from one place to another. Consequently, we're facing situations such as the one in Florida where the panther has become endangered because the habitat becomes so fragmented that mountain lions stay in smaller and smaller areas and the gene pool gets more and more shallow over time.
So, Steve Torres, with the Fish and Game Department, how does a state agency, which is committed, I presume, to maintain this wildlife, make it work when land is disappearing so rapidly?
Well, you know, it is a real challenge, and in that way, California can, in many ways, serve as kind of a case study for ultimately where other Western states are going to go. If there's one thing we know for sure is that people are going to continue to increase. Forecasts I've heard of the state of California, currently about 32 million people, is that we might be 50% larger by the year 2025. So that's a dilemma for us. It's a challenge. I mean, here our mission is to maintain the viability wildlife populations in the state, and we're a trustee agency for that. And indeed, there's a many areas that are ultimately going to be fragmented and lost to human development.
Well, let's go to the phones, and our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and let's pick up on Sharon, who is in California. Sharon, you're talking Green in the Environment Show.
Hello, Peter. I was calling because I live up in the Sierra Nevada foothills where this population explosion is occurring.
Are you seeing any mountain lions?
Well, a few. I wish I had seen some. Occasionally people say, oh, I saw one. Mostly the lions are trying to stay out of people's way. They're coming into these areas or being seen more because this is where the deer are coming. You know, people are sprawling out all over with these little ranchettes, and their landscaping is attracting a lot of deer. And, of course, that's the primary prey of cougars. I think it's real important to continue the public education program to let people know what they should do if they do encounter a mountain lion, and that normally there isn't that much of a threat, and that they're just trying to basically stay out of people's way.
Do you find that your neighbors call for either eliminating or shooting lions, getting rid of them, because people are worried that they might harm either them or their children?
Well, this was a big issue when 197 came about, and it was escalated by the fact that a couple of people's dogs were taken, and they called the county trapper, who is also a houndsman, and he did a lot of scare tactics with them and told them their children were next and all of this kind of thing, and really inflamed a lot of people, I think incorrectly, made them more afraid than they really needed to be.
Good. Well, thanks for your comment. Steve Torres, being with Fish and Game, how do you handle this question of fear that people express that their dogs, their children, whatever else are going to get eaten up by the mountain lions?
Well, you know, in many ways, you know, it's a very real concern. As I travel around the state, I mean, the diversity of opinion is as diverse as the ecology here. I mean, as you go to major ranching areas, the areas where your caller just came in from represents an area that a lot of the people commute into human population metropolitan areas, and then they commute back out into the foothills, they don't realize they've moved into an area that has a lot of wildlife, and I'll be darned, it also has mountain lions. And some people don't want to tolerate those animals. They're very afraid of them. And, you know, I hear a lot of statistics that go around where, oh, you're more likely to die of bee stings or something. And some of those statistics aren't real helpful in the long run, because what we have to do is not scare people, but inform them, alert them that these animals are out there and they are potentially dangerous. I mean, we're talking about an animal that's really the largest meat-eating carnivore in North America.
Let's go back to the phones. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and we have a call from Gray. Gray, you're on the Environment Show.
Good to be on, Peter. How are you doing?
Okay.
I've been listening to it. It is very interesting. I'm a native Californian and now living in Tucson, Arizona. But Ms. Sadler had brought up an interesting point about the protected status of the mountain lion, and Prop 117 that was passed a number of years ago did exactly that.
People that don't understand that, that was the ballot initiative that forbid the hunting of mountain lions in California? Am I right about that?
It forbid the... There was really no management scheme of mountain lions other than, as you'd said, there was a bounty and they weren't managed by the Department of Fish and Game. And interesting enough, the protected status that they now hold is exactly that. Unfortunately, Steve Torres and his agency doesn't manage the mountain lion because it is protected. It is not under the Department of Fish and Game. What Steve is managing is the bighorn sheep and the deer population that the mountain lion does prey upon. So I think the concern that many Californians have and a number of other people have is that this protected status that has been given to this creature that is an absolutely phenomenal and beautiful animal, but its populations are going through the roof, as are the human populations. I think it's estimated, and Steve certainly knows these numbers, about 4,000 to 6,000 mountain lions now in the state of California. They take about a deer a week, so that's 200,000 to 300,000 deer a year that are being taken from the deer population.
So is it your position that hunting should be permitted in order
Not even talking hunting at this point, but I just think that the Department of Fish and Game has been hamstrung by Prop 117, where they cannot manage the mountain lions. Mr. Torres mentioned that we have one attack per year in the state. What he didn't mention is last year or just the year prior, there were two deaths. These weren't children. These weren't young adults. These were two adult women, one up in Folsom, California, which is near Sacramento, a jogger, mother of two, who was eaten and mauled and eaten by a mountain lion, and then an elderly lady down in San Diego, near San Diego,
okay,
who was eaten by a mountain lion.
Okay, well, let's get some comment from our panel. Thanks for calling. Lynn, how do you react to the caller's argument that we need more management here?
Well, basically, he's got a number of his facts wrong. The mountain lion population has grown since the moratorium was made by Governor Ronald Reagan in 1972. There's no question that they were on their way out, I believe, at that point, and they have rebounded. However, the Department of Fish and Game's own records, as Steve will attest, say that at the moment there's no evidence the population is growing, and in fact it appears to be stabilized. Yes, mountain lions do eat deer. That is their main prey. But what Gray misses out on is the Department of Fish and Game acknowledges that sport hunting of mountain lions will have no effect on human attacks. Sport hunting is not related to whether or not humans are attacked. What is related is to what we talked about at the beginning, the burgeoning human population and the increase of interaction between mountain lions and humans.
Well, we've got a call waiting. Mike, you're talking Green on the Environment Show.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'm an outdoor kind of person, and I like to be out there. If I'm out there and I'm in mountain lion country, I'd like to ask your panelists, what do I need to do to protect myself? What kinds of things should I be looking for? How should I act? What if I confront a mountain lion?
Good. Okay, Steve, let's start with you. What does California Department of Fish and Game say to the outdoorsman who meets the mountain lion?
Well, in the rare and unique opportunity that you do run into one, first of all, we recommend you do not approach the animal, and certainly you don't run from the animal. We also, not a good idea to crouch down or bend over. Basically, most encounters with mountain lions, as we've found in our records, just result in that, merely an encounter. Slowly walk away from the animal, raise your arms over your head, speak loudly and steadily to the animal, moving away, eye contact, letting the animal know you're seeing it, somewhat of a challenge to it. That animal generally is very wary of people and will, at the first opportunity, move away. Most of our, of course, in the circumstance where a lion does pursue and follow and attacks, you know, fight back, you know, use whatever you have to do so.
I wish we had more time, because I think the big challenge is how we continue to live with these great wildlife critters that are running out of space, and we don't seem to be very good at disciplining ourselves in ways to preserve habitat for both. So we'd like to hear some more from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Give us a call on this issue or others. We'll be able to record your conversation, if nothing else. I'm your host, Peter Burley. Our guests have been Lynn Sadler from the Mountain Lion Foundation, Steve Torres from California Department of Fish and Game, and Rick Hopkins, who is a senior wildlife ecologist at Harvey & Associates. Again, we've been talking green, and thanks for being with us. The fate of the world's big cats now hangs in the balance as poachers who want their hides and organs and tree cutters and developers who want their habitat battle it out with environmentalists trying to save them. Perhaps killing wild beasts until there are none left is an instinct that is as old as humankind. Author Gregory McNamee tells a legend about the mythical hunter Orion, who incurred the wrath of the gods by threatening to kill every animal on Earth. He reads the story entitled Scorpion, found in his book, A Desert Bestiary, published by Johnson Books.
The constellation named for him may harbor some of the brightest stars in the night sky, but the Greek hero god Orion is a figure about whom we know strangely little. He was, it seems, a local deity of the desert province of Ionia, inducted as a supporting player into the pantheon of the Indo-European invaders when they first arrived in Greece 3 millennia ago. His name means rainbringer, a good desert epithet. And in the meteorology, Aristotle explains that the rising and setting of Orion signals the beginning and end of the rainy season, times that are considered to be treacherous and stormy, like Orion himself. Out of the tangled, sometimes contradictory myths relating to Orion, far separate from one another in time and space, let me cobble a story that goes something like this. The bear hunter Orion was the tallest and most handsome of the gods born to Euryale and the sea god Poseidon, stronger and fairer even than the mighty Otus and Ephialtes, his half-brothers, who tried to pile the mountains Ossa upon Pelion so as to storm the heavens themselves. Orion married well. Unfortunately, his wife Cide incautiously boasted that she was more beautiful than Hera, the goddess of heaven, and Hera cast her into the pit of Tartarus to ponder her vanity. Alone, Orion went to the island of Chios at the invitation of its king Oinopion, Wineface, a son of Dionysus, who asked Orion to purge the island of its wild beasts in return for his beautiful daughter Merope. For every skin that Orion brought to him, however, Oinopion insisted that there were a dozen more lions, bears, and wolves hiding in the hills, and Orion's task never seemed to end. Impatient to claim her, Orion raped Merope. Oinopion pretended to let the crime pass, but one night he encouraged Orion to drink freely as much of the wine of Chios as he cared to. When Orion fell into a sodden sleep, Oinopion cut his eyes out and cast him away on a beach. In due time, Helios, the god of the sun, restored Orion's sight to him, and Orion went seeking Oinopion to avenge himself. Oinopion had hidden in a deep cave, and not finding him on Chios, Orion went off to the palace of Minos on Crete, thinking that Minos might have sheltered Oinopion, his grandson, as it happens. Oinopion never turned up, and Orion spent his days hunting on Mount Ida. Eos, the goddess of the dawn, saw him there and fell in love with him, kidnapping him and taking him to the heavens to be her husband. But Orion, ever the hunter, tried to rape the bear goddess Artemis's attendants, the Pleiades, and Artemis set Scorpio the scorpion on Orion. Scorpio stung Orion as he slept. Both died, and both became constellations, Scorpio always pursuing the hunter in the night sky. But first, Orion's soul went to the Isles of the Dead, where, Homer says, Odysseus saw him driving lynxes and lions and other wild beasts across fields of greening asphodel, hunting the animals that he had killed in the desolate mountains in life, his unbreakable iron club in his hand. Orion's favorite hunting dog, Sirius, joined him in the heavens. So, too, did his daughters Menippe and Medioke, sacrificed by the Boeotians to rid their country of plague. Eridanus, the great winding river of the heavens, flows from Orion's heel. For, being Poseidon's son, Orion could walk on water. All of them wheel around Taurus and the great bear, whom Orion chased on Earth. In a surviving fragment of his treatise on astronomy, Hesiod remarks that Orion once threatened to kill every animal on Earth. Reason enough for the gods to stay his blood-soaked hand and set him high in the night sky, where he could do no harm, thanks to the scorpion.
That was author Gregory McNamee reading Scorpion from his book, A Desert Bestiary. Another winter has passed, and spring has arrived. On our farm in New England, we were blessed last week with a foot of new snow, which has now seeped quietly into the earth. The grass is beginning to green, and the sheep and the cows are drifting out of the barnyards and into the pasture. Barb Barton is a singer-songwriter from Middletown, Pennsylvania. She greets this time of year with a song, appropriately entitled Springtime.
Love to hear those robins sing. Love the smell of everything in the springtime. In the springtime. I love to see those crocus pop. I love to watch the mosses soak up the rainfall. In the springtime. I love the thunderstorms, I love the sunny days, I love the way it chases my blues away in the springtime. I love to hear those songs at night of people singing their delight. Springtime, springtime. Thing that I love most of all is haunting mushrooms, is to hear them calling in springtime. In the springtime, I love the thunderstorms, I love the sun. In the springtime,
Springtime by Barb Barton, off her release From the Eye of the Hawk on Asari Records. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 382. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Packard Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.